If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We are talking with Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, about what's going on, the new Epstein emails that have been dropped. There is certainly more that continue to come out, and it is a prickly place right now, trying to break it all down and trying to see things in a clear light, one that is not shadowed by, you know, the optics that we all have in our own opinions on politics this way or that way. It's looking straight at the facts of, if someone did this, whoever did this, no matter what side you're on, obviously it's not okay, and it needs to be called out, and they need to be exposed. In some of these emails, Epstein also calls Trump a dog that hasn't barked. I found that an interesting phrase, and I don't even know how to take it. I'm curious, from a behavioral standpoint, what your take is on that, Robin.
Yeah, so it shows a lack of closeness. It shows his typical objectification of individuals, and also shows he's not an insider in his tight circle. It looked like he was, in Epstein's mind, that he was a pet that is able to be controlled from his standpoint, that viewpoint. So it's I think the way he regarded Trump calling him a dog like that is probably how he regarded absolutely everyone, with the exception of maybe Maxwell herself. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think that just gave him insight, not necessarily on Trump as an individual, but how Epstein saw pretty much everyone.
And everybody was a tool for him to use.
100%. 100%. And that's why he went cross, because he wasn't trying to ally himself with Trump or with Clinton or with Bill Gates or with the prince over in the UK. This was all about servicing him. I mean, and you can see it with how he regarded all the girls.
Yeah.
He thought this was exactly how people should be treated. It's the sickest, mind-blowingest thing when you read that book, to see how he saw people. He didn't see them as people, because remember, he's not a person himself. So how can he view anyone else as a person when he's not a person? Remember, soul ripper.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Inhuman.
And he was able to live in an ecosystem that never proved him wrong. I mean, even when it did, it handled him with kid gloves because of the information that he possessed on so many other people. That's why he had such a slap on the wrist the first time he was indicted and arrested for his crimes. And then he comes back out, and then he's like friendly with all it, it's like I compare it to R. Kelly in some ways, just as society treated R. Kelly, where we knew what he did. There was video of him violating a 14-year-old girl in his bathroom in front of his Soul Train Award. And everybody's like, well, maybe it's not him. I want to step in the name of love at my wedding. So I'm going to go with that. And that remix to Ignition, that's a pretty hot jam, you got to admit. All that stuff over here, him with the 14-year-old... This is how society treated R. Kelly, and he had a huge career even after all that came out. And Epstein was able to essentially do the same sort of thing. It wasn't in spotlights and music videos in the R&B world. It was the rich and powerful and the elite that still felt safe enough, just as music artists felt safe enough to go and do a duet with R. Kelly after that shit, to go on tour with him after that shit, because the public said, nah, we're okay with this. So the rich and the powerful continued to have relationships with Jeffrey Epstein even after they knew the allegations against him. And the DOJ says there is no evidence that Trump participated in Epstein's crimes, even in some of Epstein's own writings. Epstein even says Trump didn't get the massages. Now, you may not like that. It may not go with the narrative you want. I'm not a huge fan of him personally. I don't care if you are. You're entitled to that opinion. It doesn't fit the narrative that I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to hear this. But I'm okay with that because it's reality on reality's terms. There's a lot of other shit here. There's a difference between no evidence of participation and no ethical concerns at all. Those are two different things. And they're very different in terms of what is prosecutable or not. Can you speak to that, Robin?
100%. We've said that on this show numerous times. Just because it's not illegal doesn't mean it's ethical. We've seen this all the time. In this case, especially going all the way back, and you hit it, you know, he was prosecuted back in the early 2000s and convicted, and he got a slap on the wrist. Yep. That slap on the wrist he got says more about the sentencing guidelines and the sentencer, the prosecutor in this case, who wound up going on to serve even other higher places in our government, says more about them than it did about Epstein. And the fact that, again, the brazenness of the normalized behavior is what was really shocking for so long. And that's what I think is just so, because the behavior never changed. He was never changing his behavior. Even after Prince Andrew, he didn't change his behavior. None of these people change their behavior because there's zero need in their own minds from what they saw, from the power they had, from the compromising information they had. And I don't even think they thought necessarily about compromising information, because that would be thinking too hard. They were just being who they were, which is these abhorrent people. So, did I cover the question? I don't even remember. I guess I did.
I think you did.
I'm going to talk about, the victims themselves. And there seems to be a fundamental crack in how one sect of our society is looking at this and how another sect of our society is looking at this. And I don't know any better way to make an example of this other than what Megyn Kelly said just the other day. And I'm kind of shocked by it. The only thing I could think, and I hope she comes back and walks it back and says, look, I misspoke. Because we all misspeak. It happens.
She's human.
We're all human. She equated, there's a big difference between, I'm paraphrasing here.
It's bad.
Well, there's a difference between a 5-year-old and a 15-year-old, and that she's really close to somebody that knows almost all the details about Jeffrey Epstein, almost all of them. Not everything, because nobody can, but almost everything. And that Epstein was into the barely legal, like 15-year-olds. And this is what she says, 15-year-olds. And things like that. They're not five, they're 15. And just kind of moves the conversation along as if that's okay, as if a 15-year-old, as if an adult interested in a 15-year-old is not a pedophile. Like, that's what was insinuated. At least that's what the conversation seemed to convey. And I hope to God she just fucked up her words and that she didn't realize how that came across was caught up in the interview, was moving on to the next topic. I get it. I do interviews too. I get it. You kind of, you're playing ping pong here back and forth, and your mind can move very fast. And I hope to God that's what she meant.
I hope
but
so.
I don't, and I don't know if it is or not, but even if it's not, there is a good sect of society that will look at it that way, that, well, she went through puberty, so now she looks like a woman, so that must make it okay. And there seems to be some weird acceptance that people are like, well, he wasn't diddling five-year-olds or allegedly, but it was 15-year-olds, so that somehow makes it less bad.
They're close to the age of consent. They're
somehow makes it less bad. Like, no, it doesn't. They're both children.
My only response is read the book.
Yeah.
You see the impact of that action. And besides, when people say things exactly like that, you sound exactly like Epstein. That's exactly what Epstein said. That is exactly word for word what he said to rationalize his abuse of little girls. He said, well, in some societies and some time frames in history, this was completely acceptable. If you go to this state, it's this. The age of consent is this, and age of consent is over here is this. And besides that, I don't remember if it, I'm almost positive. I can't be 100%, but I'm almost positive that a lot of the photos he had was of girls younger than 15.
Yeah.
So rationalizing abusing girls, I don't care if they've been through menopause. I mean, not menopause, if they've been through
puberty.
Puberty or not yet. It's stupid. You look
at what? Yes. Why is this even coming out of her mouth? Why is this even like, why is there even any rationalization going on? I mean, it's not rocket science to say someone looks physically different than at 15 and 5. Of course, yes. But it doesn't in any way, shape, or form make it more valid or less or more of a temptation. But to justify that an adult can prey on that person with less consequence,
and
because she looks more mature than a 5.
And I'll tell you what, the way Epstein did this and Maxwell did this, I don't care if they're 15 or 25.
No,
right. They were manipulated.
The book.
Exactly.
They were trafficked. So this is a big problem in our society. Tony, you and I have covered cases like this before with serial rapists, because that's exactly what this is. So when you get a certain part of our society where girls start getting trafficked like they did at this age, they grow up into – they are trafficked all the way up until they friggin' die.
Yeah.
And right up into their 20s, 30s, if they live that long. And the psychological destruction of that human being, it doesn't matter if it's 15 or 25. They're being trafficked. They're trapped. And they're – I mean, they get trauma bonded, they get guilted, they get shamed, and they get manipulated the hell out of. And so it doesn't matter if they're 15, 25, 30, that was an abuse and enslavement, because that's what trafficking is. It is enslavement. Well, they say, you know, and then all – and here's what I say to any – because I get it. If you don't have – if you never touched it, tasted or felt it, you know, where you got really close and really gritty in the minutia of the impact it has on the victims, you don't get it. Read the book. Mm-hmm. To me, I've been harping on this one. This is like mandatory reading for anyone that is truly trying to understand the impact that this inhuman individual like Epstein has on human beings. I don't care
from the start, years.
It's even worse at that young age, but it's because remember, Jenna, she died in her 30s, and she's still traumatized by this. All these girls are.
It doesn't matter.
Go ahead.
There was a comment a couple of days ago. Somebody had watched us talking about this, I think a week ago or a week and a half ago, and they said, nobody chained these girls to the massage tables, or they weren't locked up or something to that effect. And I wanted to comment back, and I stepped back and I went, this is a person who has not seen somebody who's been traumatized and manipulated and trafficked. There's so much fear around this. And Megyn Kelly making that comment, it's so cringeworthy, because how many victims are out there going, well, I was going to say something, but wow, we're normalizing this behavior that, you know, close enough.
Wrong. Yeah, it was Megyn Kelly having a conversation with another female, too.
Yeah, and that just...
I'm like,
What fucking planet are we on?
You're supposed to be able to go to... Robin, was it you that said find a person with children that's a safe person?
Yeah.
Yeah. A discussion that we had about if you're out in public and you're looking for somebody to go to when you're in trouble, it should be, what, a woman who has a child?
That's why I'm it's hard to imagine she's not going to retract that in some way. I mean, she's a mother. I hope to God.
I mean, at this point, I'm sorry. At this point, I don't normally get involved, but Tony, you said, you know, sometimes when you're interviewing, you're trying to get to the next thing. On this topic, if you are a skilled interviewer, you are very careful about how you handle that interview.
Yeah.
And obviously,
especially with sensitive
she was not. And also, that's when your true self comes out, are in those moments. I will say that till the day I die.
Yeah, I agree. And I think when you're too close to the fire, when you're too connected to these individuals from a political standpoint, which she is, you're human. She's human. And you're going to be influenced one way or another. And the modality of going down a road, trying to somehow rationalize the number 15 and putting that number out there, picking that one and saying that that is somehow acceptable. There's like two roads I think you can go down here with this. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you protecting this? Or is there some sort of rationalization and something else going on inside that individual that's trying to make sense of their own trauma and trying to normalize some sort of horrible shit that went on with themselves? And I'm not saying, I have no fucking idea what her history is, what her story is. I hope to God she didn't suffer through some sort of shit like this, but that's the only other modality I can think of that someone would be trying to rationalize some sort of shit like this to somehow soften the blow of their own trauma that they are trying to deal with themselves. And I'm not saying that's what's happening. I don't know the answer, but I'm trying to give some grace here because it's so fucking out there, but everything is so out there right now.
I don't want to give grace because Todd brought up a very good point. You know, we prep before we come on the lives here. We do our research. We write up questions. We
lots.
You know, we lots of research. Robin probably more than anybody. Prepping.
It's just fucking common sense. You don't say, like, unless you're going to say, why would you even say that? It's
not
like you're just
know.
Like reading us. Like if you're just reading your prompter and this is what's coming up, then you're a shitty interviewer.
Well,
I mean,
go
but
back
even
to
then,
Anchorman.
I'd be like, I read my prompter in front of me and I made the questions. And sometimes I'm like, I don't like how that's worded. I'm going to change this.
I went in and rewrote my questions before we got started. So
70% of the questions I ask are not pre-made.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know how that comes out of your mouth if you're a sane human being.
I still can't get over though. I don't think it matters even if it was 15. If any of these girls were 20. So?
Yeah.
It's still abhorrent. It's still wrong. They're still trafficked. They're still enslaved by these people. All I can keep saying is read the book. Read the book.
Yeah.
You know, I've covered these cases. I've covered my own cases where people have done abhorrent things, but I've read journals of the bad guys. I've never read anything by the victim.
Yeah.
This was a victim's transparent journal of her life and what happened to her. I have never in my life read something like this. It gave me, and I view myself, hopefully, and other people too, as an extremely empathetic, caring individual that champions the rights and the liberties and the mental health and wellness of absolutely everyone, especially children. I have two. They're my life. They're everything in my life. And this book, so matter of fact, my daughter, it was my birthday this past weekend. As you all know, my daughter came home for my birthday and she had one of her friends come. And her friend, my daughter, is bragging a little bit, say, hey, you know, my dad does true crime stuff with Tony Bruschi. And she goes, oh, really? And the girl said, her friend says, I'm reading Nobody's Girl. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Did you two just talk for hours on this?
Yeah, but I said, and she just started, I said, and I cautioned her. I said,
this
is a powerful book, but I said, you got to tread lightly, touch your toe in that water, because this is powerful stuff. Because that's the impact this book had on me. And I'm telling you, for anyone that makes a comment like that, If you read the book and still make comments like that, you need some counseling.
Yes. I don't know any other way to slice it. I really don't. And I know, I don't know. I just
And as
don't
a
know.
Woman, it's incredibly disappointing that
I
she would say that.
I think that's why we're trying to give Grace too, because I'm shocked because of knowing a little bit of her background, a little bit of what she went through, why she left Fox and having kids.
Right.
You know, I'm like,
look, they watch our show. They've reached out to us before on guests and stuff. And, you know, I respect her as a journalist, but I saw, I'm like, what the fuck are you saying?
Yeah.
Seriously, Megan, step back, retract that shit.
It's a moment.
Please.
I'd welcome her to come on with us and explain what she meant.
Jesus Christ. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just, my head is spinning on this. I can get political differences. I can get, we can have different opinions and view things this way. But what the fuck was that? Yeah. This is 1,000 times more vile than the stupid shit she got fired at NBC for on the Today Show. I mean, this is just like, what the fuck? This is like fundamentally weird. There's reports that agents were told to flag Epstein records that reference Trump and other powerful figures. People are going to have this in their mind, and it may be true. It's reports. You've lived inside that world. You know, what kind of internal, what does that actually mean? Are there things like this that happen? Are there things where it's like, okay, we're going to go through this, but if you find this, we don't need to know about that.
Not on that angle of it. I come from a world inside the FBI where I saw a lot of, I understand the background. So a lot of times when I'm shining my flashlight in dark places, I know some people get angry sometimes, but I'm just telling you like the bureaucracy works and why there's certain things and how it can, we did certain things a certain way, yet when it grabs the public eye, it's easy to say, well, it's cover up or it's this or this. No, I'm just telling you how the bureaucracy worked and why. And this is one of those cases. There was numerous cases that I worked or instances throughout my career where we're told, hey, go through all your interviews, go through everything, go through all your files and find anything related to this. We were never told to do anything in my 22 years with the FBI to find it so we could cover it up. Mm-hmm. We were always told to find it because we had to disclose it. And if we couldn't, and I'll tell you, the threat of reciprocity, if we did not find everything and was later found out that we didn't disclose it, was massive. I mean, we'd be put under an OPR for that.
Could that be used in reverse, though, where it's like, okay, your job, go find this, and you don't know that it's necessarily for, you're disclosing it, but what's the purpose of disclosure? Is it to release it publicly? Is it to be part of the file? Or is it to, okay, find this so we can redact this?
I was just going to ask about redacting. Everything we're going to see redacted?
Like, find it. We need somebody to find it.
True.
But there's a reason for finding it. It's not to, like, shine light. It's to, let's sweep this away.
In every single case I've ever had, I can't name them all off the top of my head, but I think there's at least 10 to 20 times throughout the course of my career where we're given a bureau-wide blast, find anything related to this. Mm-hmm. And we're always told why, and it was always because we have a congressional mandate, there's a FOIA request, there's something. So we were always told the reason why we had to find this information and how and where it was going to be going. But the likelihood, again, because I just go to laws of numbers, for someone to collect all the information to cover it up, I don't know. It just doesn't work because there's too many people who would know it. So if someone put out an all call for information, the likelihood that that's an all call to shove it in a corner someplace, slim mm-hmm. to none, because it just wouldn't work. Just the human, again, look at all the people that were fired. Look at all the people that left. You know, there's just too much. There's too many holes in that bucket to be able to fill, to be able to do that effectively. The other thing that came up, and it'll come up sometimes too, is if for high level people that we're investigating or have to interview, because I know a lot of times, you know, someone has to be flagged that, hey, say we have to go interview. Like I've been part of this when my buddy was doing insider insider investigations and leak investigations. I mean, I was very close to guys doing this, where we have to go interview the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of War, whoever he is now, or the President or members of Congress or anything. And what happens in those cases, very similar to these, is they get flagged, not flagged because they're going to be treated special. What typically happens, at least in all the cases I've been involved in, there can be outliers, but 22 years I'm involved in a lot, and I didn't see anything that deviated from this. And that is, these people get flagged at this higher level so that you can bring an executive with you at a similar rank with the investigator. So what happens is, so say Robin Dreek, I'm a GS-13 journeyman level as a special agent. It is my case I'm operating. Say I have to go interview the Secretary of Defense, or say I have to go interview a member of Congress, a senator or something. What will typically happen is that an executive from headquarters, that's a senior executive staff member, in other words, they have the same sort of civilian rank inside the FBI as this individual, will come along on the interview with the investigator who's actually doing the interview themselves. Why? I don't know. It's protocol, but it's never an influence type thing like I've been part of anyway. Typically, the executive will sit there, a small chit chat, and then and they'll hand it off to the interviewer, and the interviewer goes. So that is typically how it works, at least in my 22 years.
I want to throw this out there because this is kind of an observation I made yesterday. And sometimes, you know, with time, time puts things into perspectives. You kind of go, oh, I didn't quite see it that way. I feel that way when I watch Dateline a lot. Even when I watch Dateline on stories that I already know really well, it's like, oh, well, when you kind of put the pieces together of the puzzle like this, new things emerge and new ways of looking at things emerge. And I don't know if I've just been blind to this the whole time. I mean, Epstein's death in itself in 2019, obviously a lot of people, myself included, I don't buy that he killed himself. I don't think that occurred. The fact that you don't have any cameras, that there's just happens to be all these oversights that would have been able to prove that in fact he did it himself don't exist. And they're, this didn't work right. Bullshit. Like, he was killed.
It's what me say, a outlier of probabilities.
Yes, it is. 1,000%.
Okay,
so we had that. We had, well, and the thought process was, well, you know, powerful people had him killed. I don't think anybody said specifically it was this person that had him killed. It was that, like, probably a collective, maybe one that had the insight or the power to do so. But now we have perspective of these emails, and we see the dates of these emails, and we see who they were from, and who they were to, and what they were discussing, and when, and what. And there happens to be a lot of shit about Trump in them. And again, not Trump that he was doing things with the girls, but that Trump had a lot of leverage, or that Epstein had a lot of shit over Trump, business dealing wise, professional wise, enough that could destroy him professionally, you know, could get him in trouble financially. Just a lot of shit. And that's the mountain of shit over here. And it's interesting because he's talking about this in these emails. He's talking about delivering this information to Russia. He's talking about having this information and being able to hold it over his head. And then suddenly Jeffrey Epstein dies while Trump is president of the United States. I wonder who had him killed.
Oh, God, here come the black SUVs.
I think
they're pulling up now.
You know, the challenge.
I'm not saying it was him. I'm just saying I wonder, because you put things in certain places. You go, this is curious.
So with all the emails that are able to be coming, I think about 2,000 pages or something like this. Here's what I think. I think that list of people that could have done that is so long.
Yeah,
It is. And this is just another one, but it's like all these emails line up where it's like, all right,
I will go down the conspiracy theory path with you, which I never, ever do. If we're looking for a pattern of behavior from past conspiracy theory conjecture, the only one that really fits a pattern, Clinton.
I was just going to say, or Clinton.
Right?
Or Clinton. No, you're exactly right. You are exactly right. Well, without
and
a
again,
doubt.
People have died in Clinton's wake. I mean, there's a circle there.
Yes. You're right. No, you're right. And this is about dealing with reality on reality's terms.
Right.
Yeah.
No matter who you like, who you, you know, whatever. It is reality. There is a track record there. If you believe those conspiracies of a lot of suspicious deaths around the Clintons, and there's a shitload of
them. There are.
And yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I would say the email evidence with Trump also rather curious. I don't know. I wonder, but it's another set of data that leads up to person with power, with information over a lot of people that suspiciously dies right at a crescendo of where this person is at the height of their power to expose you at one of your most vulnerable times and the most powerful time in your existence. And that's what Epstein held over Trump at that moment in time. He also held it over the Clintons. He also held it over a ton of other people, too. So I don't know. I mean, I'm literally throwing it out there going, I don't know, but that's a new observation.
So here's what I'd be doing if I was the investigator and had access to all this thing as a behaviorist, because again, I just look at the behavior and I look for patterns. So we have a pattern of at least one individual known, convicted, and dethroned of Andrew, Prince Andrew, or just Andrew Windsor, whatever hell he is, right? So I would take that as a baseline of someone who is very witting of what was going on at a high, powerful level. You then take an overlay of how that communication goes, the words, usage of the back and forth. And now we have a profile of someone that was on the inner circle, inner knowledge, who is corrupt. All right. Mm-hmm. We then take that as a baseline of what we're typically looking for the types of communication language used. What did Epstein refer to him as a dog or not as a dog? I mean, any kind of little clue you can get. You then take that as the model and you overlay it with all the other people that had email communications with Epstein and see what stands out from that baseline of normal. Because there's going to be a lot of just routine emails that are going to be baseline. And then you're going to see the Andrew one. It's going to be a spike. We're going to take that spike, take the profile of that one and see where it overlays with everything else. And that just gives you, all right, we have some smoke. Now we got some big billows of smoke. Let's go investigate these big billows of smoke and see where this leads us. And that's what I'd be doing as the investigator is like, I have a known entity. Now I'm going to model that mode, that known entity, and see who else might fit that known entity and see where we need to investigate further. Because again, I'm not saying yes, Trump, no, Trump. I'm saying my conjecture is that Trump is one of emails that probably sound a lot like a lot of other emails.
Sure.
Was talking about and it might not be, and it could be an outlier, but we don't know if it's an outlier or not unless we have a baseline of how Epstein communicated with a lot of people. That's what I'd like to see who stands out.
It's another it's a chessboard, and Trump is one of the pieces on that board.
Yes, one.
And he's one. He happens to be the one that's in a certain place of power right now at the time some of these things were going on, of what he did or did not have knowledge to. He was at a very different place on that chessboard. And Epstein is the one who's the player. He's the one who was playing the pieces and all the way up to his death. And it appears as though some of those pieces on the chessboard somehow got a mind of their own and found a way to kill the person playing with them. How many of those pieces? I don't know the answer to that question, but that observation, I think, is one to note in terms of timing. There's so many questions that are still left unknown. The fact that we don't have a lot of these files yet, with tons of these emails are dropping and they're going to continue over the next, probably for the rest of our lives.
It's like New Year's Eve.
You know, but the reality of it is, and I'm going to ask you this, Robin, why should the public trust anything that's coming out in any of these emails or any of the Epstein files or any lists or this or that? There's been plenty of time to redact whatever needs to be redacted. There's plenty of time to delete shit that needs to be deleted. There's plenty of time to do all of this and all of that to create a public ready version of it. And all the government has to do is say, well, it encroaches on national security, so we're not going to tell you these names of these certain people. And it might. it very well might encroach on national security because of people being compromised for these very reasons. But at the same time, that uncomfortableness, that possibility of a national security risk protects the people simultaneously.
Yeah.
I would just go down the road of does this make sense behaviorally that this would act like this way? But I'm not looking for things that are going to be that I don't believe, because we're going to see tons we don't believe and that we're going to be skeptical of. What I'm looking for is I'm looking for an individual, an organization, an institution that does this. They say, in further review, we got this wrong. We made a mistake. Here's what we now know. And when they share that information, if it's not a good look for them, yet they still have the courage to share it, I'm paying attention to those people. Mm-hmm. Because people that have the courage to say, I made a mistake, are the ones that have a lot more credibility than anyone else. Because everyone else is saying, not me. You know, and they're pointing over here. Those are the ones I never believe. Because there's a lot of rules of human behavior. One, we're all going to act in our own best interest in terms of our safety, security, and prosperity. For ourselves and those we care about. That's what we're seeing right here. People are acting out of fear and their own safety. Here's another rule of human behavior that is the greatest thing when we're looking for assessing trustworthiness in others. We are all working on something. All of us are incredibly flawed. The people that have the courage to share their flaws and share where they're vulnerable and say, here's where I'm a little broken, but here's what I'm doing about it. Those are the ones you can trust, because those are the ones that are saying, I am broken. I'm not perfect. Everyone else around us, they're all saying they're perfect. Don't believe them. They're not.
And there's self-awareness, which so many of these people seem to not have.
Namaste.
Namaste. All right, we solved the world's problems again. Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Your current book, Unbreakable Alliances, available wherever books are sold. Go check it out. As always, invaluable having you on. Thank you so much, my friend, for being here. There's a lot more to come on this topic. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of these conversations wherever you're listening, wherever you're watching. Your comments are certainly one. And needed. YouTube is where you'll find us. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. Until next time, for Robin, Todd, and Stacy, I'm Tony Brewski. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.